Well, today we're continuing in our series on the successful Christian life, and specifically the new supernatural ability that we have as Christians to be humble. We started this discussion last week, but today we want to talk about how the Lord overcomes our reluctance to serve others and our compulsion to compete with others. And it's a really big topic. No matter how far along you are in the Christian life, this is very difficult. And last week I joked somewhat about feeling awkward even preaching about these things, because how can you possibly preach about being humble without sounding like you're proud? It's just so weird for me to be doing this, but I'm doing the best I can, removing myself from the situation. But this is a big problem. Remember, I showed you this last week. A.W. Tozer, in his book Pursuit of God, says, to be specific, the self-sins are self-righteousness, self-pity, self-confidence, self-sufficiency, self-admiration, self-love, and a host of others like them. They dwell too deep within us and are too much a part of our natures to come to our attention till the light of God is focused on them. Self can be removed only in spiritual experience, never by mere instruction. We must invite the cross to do its deadly work within us. We must bring our self-sins to the cross for judgment. In other words, we have to present our bodies a living sacrifice to the Lord and say, I do want this to be different. I commit myself to you. Carve away all of these things that don't belong in my life. Do the work in my heart that the Holy Spirit wants to do. I yield to that. And then the Lord does indeed change us. And no matter how far along you are in the Christian life, this is going to be something for you to contend with. F.B. Meyer, who was a very, very important preacher at the turn of the last century, used to talk about being outside his church doors on a Sunday morning and watching people go in their carriages past his church to C.H. Spurgeon's church, because he was just across town in London. And he said that was kind of hard not to be jealous. In fact, he was jealous. He was competing. And he didn't mean to. It just happened. And he's one of the best, right? And he still is jealous over the prosperity of somebody else, even in Christian ways. And then later he became a popular conference speaker at the Keswick conferences there. It's a lakeside resort area in England. He was a popular speaker, and along came G. Campbell Morgan. And G. Campbell Morgan became more popular than he was. He said sometimes somebody would be listening to G. Campbell Morgan preach, and when it was F.B. Meyer's turn to preach, the people would stand up and leave. It's like, oh, how do you live with that? And he talked about how hard that was for him to avoid the sin of jealousy. And in fact, he fought with that, and he gained victory over that by going to people and saying, did you hear what G. Campbell Morgan said this morning? Wasn't that great? And he was fighting against the spirit of competition and pride that wells up in all of us. So here's the season so far. Oh, we've talked about the successful Christian being new in every way, having a new perspective, having new emotions, a new ability to impact the world through our prayers, through supernatural connections with others. The Lord gives us a magnetism, a charm, if you will, by supernatural gifts, spiritual gifts and abilities, the ability to love and forgive, the ability to resist temptation, and today and last week, the ability to be humble. And this is a supernatural ability. Nobody can be humble unless the Lord is making the changes in that person's heart. It's supernatural. All right, so today, the new ability to be humble versus the reluctance to serve people like we should and the compulsion to compete with people like we should not. Children have a hard time with this, and then it just stays with us all through our lives. You'll hear a child say, hey, my grades are better than yours, ha, ha, ha. You know what that is? That's pride, it's arrogance, it's a spirit of competition. And it never goes away. We are like children, because then we say, I'm stronger than he is, and we say, I'm faster than he is, I'm more handsome or beautiful than he, she is, I am able to sing better, my talents are better, I have a better house, I have a better car, I have a better wardrobe, and we're like children. That's competition. It never goes away. In sports, we chant, we're number one, we're number one. You realize, of course, that's very ugly. Our friend, Frank Sinatra, sings, "I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap, top of the list, a number one." Like, nice. Well, we all have a hard time with that, don't we? And so we're talking about arrogantly imagining that something in my life, other than my relationship with Jesus Christ, arrogantly imagining that something in my life is more important than serving others. And we do imagine that. But you're going to see that that's not true. There's nothing in your life more important than serving other people, except for your personal relationship with the Lord. And arrogantly imagining that competing with others is somehow good. And we have a problem with this. So when we talk about the ability, the supernatural ability God gives us to be humble, we are striking at the core of the human sin problem. It goes as deep as any sin can possibly go with us, and it manifests itself in many ugly ways. My great need is to quell my urge to select when and whom I serve, and to sort out whom I think of as being worthy of my efforts. Because I always think, sure, I'm going to serve that guy, but not that guy. Or I'm going to serve on this occasion, but not on this occasion. You know, this is me time, or whatever we're going to call it, and I'm not going to serve on that occasion. And then we think, well, you know, I think that guy is worthy of my efforts and that guy isn't. And we have a hard time figuring this out. Humility requires the acknowledgement that a great Christian life, if you want to be a great Christian life is almost entirely conditioned upon serving others. In Mark chapter 10, we have this very important teaching of Jesus, and it's elsewhere in Scripture as well. But in this text, Jesus called them to him. He says to them, "You know that they which are accounted to rule over the Gentiles exercise lordship, control. They're control freaks over them. And their great ones exercise authority, control upon them. But so shall it not be among you. But whoever will be great among you shall be your servant, minister. And whoever of you will be chiefest shall be servant of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give." All right, so what you see there is Jesus saying, if you want to be the great Christian, if you want to be great, you have to serve. And if you want to be the greatest of all, the chiefest of all, you want to be, you know, great, you have to serve people. You want to be the greatest, then you have to serve everybody. Wow. So in other words, your greatness in Christ's administration is almost entirely conditioned upon who you serve. And if you want to be the greatest, then you have to serve everybody. You're the servant of everybody. And that is so counterintuitive. We say, look, you know, what do you have, two broken legs? I'm not your servant. Get it yourself. Yeah, well, that attitude is ugly. Because if you want to be great in Christ's kingdom, that means you serve. And if you want to be the greatest, that means you serve everybody. You serve who? That guy you don't like at work? That neighbor who's so stingy and cranky? Yep. If you want to be the greatest, then you serve everybody. That's how this works. And we have to resist the urge to be selective about whom we serve. That is, if you want to be chiefest, you have to be servant of everybody. And even the urge to select who you're going to serve is evil. If you want to be the greatest Christian, you have to serve everybody. Now, little, proviso and condition. We're not saying you have to somehow do away with the urge that comes from divine wisdom. Jesus taught us to select the people who are reachable and teachable, right? You don't go after the hard cases and cast your pearls before a swine. You go after the seekers. So that principle's in Scripture, like shaking the dust off your feet, that's obviously selecting whom you're going to serve, right? But what we're talking about is an evil urge to select based on your own preferences who you're going to serve. So I want to serve him because he's nice. I want to be around him, so I'm going to serve him. You know what? I just like you, so I'm going to do something nice for you. Great, you know, great. But not just that guy. You have to be perfectly willing in your heart of hearts to serve the guy who is not nice to you. The guy who is cranky. the guy you would never ordinarily choose to serve. So we are not selecting on the basis of who I like to be around. You realize that it takes no moral courage if, I don't know, some celebrity. I can't think of who everybody likes right now. How about, I know this isn't going to work, Tom Cruise. If Tom Cruise comes in here and everybody says, oh, can I get you a drink of water? Would you like to have one of the pies? I'll get that for you. Well, sure, everybody's going to do that for Tom Cruise because you want to get his favor. See, there's no moral courage in that. Jesus says, if you want to be the greatest Christian, you have to serve everybody. And nobody's getting left out. You may choose to serve this person at this time instead of that person because there are 7 billion people in the world and you can't serve them all at the same time. You're going to have to select. But the selection is not based on what this is going to give me in a cost-benefit analysis. It's going to be, I would serve anybody that the Lord wants me to serve, just anybody at all, because I just want to serve everyone. And the urge to select this person and not that person is evil. You can select them based on divine wisdom, but not on a cost-benefit analysis. I like you, so I'm going to serve you. That is not what we're after. In Mark 10:43, again, we're reminded that we're going to serve all. And in the 1 Corinthians 13:5 text, we're reminded that love doesn't seek its own. So I'm not going to serve you because when I'm with you, you make me feel so good, so I want to do something nice for you. We're saying I'm not seeking the benefit in this cost-benefit analysis. I'm not seeking that. I'm not seeking my own. I just want to know who the Lord wants me to serve, and I'll do it. In 2 Corinthians 12:14, you see how you're not choosing the people you want to be with and deciding to help them because they're just so sweet and nice to you. Paul himself, such an excellent example of this. Notice who he serves. Behold, the third time I'm ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you, for I seek not yours but you. See, a cost-benefit analysis. I'm not trying to get anything from you. I'm just wanting to take care of you. I seek not what you have, but I seek you. And he said, and his thought is like parenting. He says, for children ought not to lay up things for their parents, you know, savings account for their parents. But parents have a savings account for the children. And here it is in verse 15. And I will very gladly spend and be spent for you, though the more abundantly I love you, the less I am loved. Isn't that amazing? So I'm not selecting to serve you because you're so nice to me. And when we get together and I serve you, I give you tea, I give you pie, whatever. And it's just so nice to me. He said, the truth is, the more I serve you, the less you love me. And I don't care. I will always serve you. I'm not selecting who I serve because I like to be with you and I'm overlooking you because I don't like to be with you. It's the more abundantly I love you, the less I am loved. But I don't care because God has given you to me and I will spend my life on you. And that's quite a thing. In Galatians 6:3, if a man thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. The operative term there is when he is nothing. So I'm not serving you because I'm going to get anything. I'm serving you because I think I'm nothing. You know, there's nobody who's beneath me. I'll serve anybody. Philippians 2:3, and let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem, estimate, think of the other person as better than himself. So You're not beneath me, you know. You're not beneath my dignity. I'll serve you. You're better than I am. I'll serve you. And so this thought of I'm going to serve you because you're nice and you give me a good feeling and you thank me afterwards, that's not the idea. The idea is you serve everybody. You don't select who you're going to serve and who you're going to bypass. The Lord will select certain people for you. It has nothing to do with whatever they can make you feel better about yourself or anything like that. In Romans 15:1, we then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak and not please ourselves. I'm not serving you because I get something out of this. I'm not overlooking the person that I don't want to be with. That's not the right idea. A 14-year-old girl at a modeling and talent convention describe, you know, why she wants to be famous. She said, I'm a princess. It's not my fault. My mom always told me, always shine, never blend. Her mom says, oh, yes. She loves being pampered. She loves someone doing her nails. She loves someone rubbing lotion on her feet. And she likes the attention. She's a brat. It's so easy. You think, well, yeah, you know, I would never do anything like that. It's so easy for us to be somewhat like that if we are not entirely like that. Sure, you know, I want everybody to take care of me. I don't want to take care of them. And so if I serve anybody, which I am reluctant to do, I'm going to serve the people that I like to be with. But I really like it when people do my nails and lotion my feet, you know, which is kind of gross to me, but okay. And we're so easily led astray into that mindset. Two of the nine characteristics of actually having a narcissistic personality disorder are a heightened sense of entitlement leading to unreasonable expectations that others should treat him especially favorably or comply automatically with his expectations. You know, I don't want to serve you. I want you to serve me. I'm special and you're not. I'm above you. You're beneath me. So I want you to serve me. That's one of the signs that you're a real sicko. The second one there is like it. A tendency to be interpersonally exploitive. I want to get something from you. So I don't want to serve you. I want to suck your blood out. You know, what do you have? You have time for me? Let me get that. You have money for me? Well, let me get that. You have flattery for me? Let me get that. And I'll suck all the lifeblood out of you. I have no intention of serving others. Well, there's a tendency for narcissistic people to be exploitive. And deep in our own hearts, we think, uh-oh, I see that in me sometimes too. So we've talked about arrogantly selecting whom to serve and when to serve. Let's talk about this. Arrogantly imagining that competing with others is somehow good. We are very competitive people, and that's not good. We think it's good. It's not good. I need to quell my urges. My urges to be ahead of others and my urges to look away from what's happening in my thinking. I need to figure out why I want to be ahead all the time. And that's hard for us to do. Humility requires the acknowledgement that even the urge to compete with others is evil. Now, once again, conditions and provisos, right? Not the raw data of any given competition. You know, we're not saying that the Olympics are bad. We're not talking about that. We're talking about my personal pursuit of status and my inability to prioritize the suffering of others, the prosperity of others when I'm competing. So the question that arises is, why must I get ahead? And when I get ahead and somebody over here is losing, why doesn't that bother me? Because I'm supposed to be caring about the guy who's losing, right? So what is this great need for me to be ahead? And why is it that the other person's suffering isn't my priority right now? Only my getting ahead. You see? And there is a paradigm for this. For all of you who play sports and everything, don't check out on me right now, okay? Because I'm saying that there is a place for competition. But don't check out on me because this place is limited. And I think the paradigm pattern you'd most readily understand is with a child and a parent. So in a parent-child relationship, all of you who have had children, we have gone and we have played with our children. From the time they could barely walk, we've played with our children and grandchildren if you have them. And, you know, when we were playing, say, basketball with our children, we didn't see them, you know, this tall, trying to make a shot. And we take the basketball and just pack it. Boom, you know, yay, you know, I got him. Like, you would never do that. You're trying to help him win. Why are you doing that? Why are you backing off and trying to help your child win, be successful? Why? The answer is because you love him. And every once in a while, you might show your child what you can really do. Like, you'll take the baseball bat in your hand and throw the ball up in the air and smack it, and it goes, you know, 200 feet away on the field, and your little boy says, wow. You say, well, you know, that was amazing for the child. There's a place in competition for that. In a perfectly loving world, we would still have running races. You know, you don't have to tell my little grandchildren to run. They just do. As a matter of fact, you have to tell them to stop running. There's a childish joy in just running. You know, why do you do that? Like, I don't know. Let's go. You know? And that's great. In a perfectly loving world, the fastest people in the world would still get together for Olympics and they would run. But the running would be for the joy of it. It's like when you go to the circus and you watch somebody perform, you don't think, oh, well, it's really important that that acrobat beats that acrobat. It's like, no, this is awesome. Look what they can do. Isn't that great? And there's no thought of this person prospering and that person suffering. That's not what you do when you have kids. All right, so what's the big difference now once we get, you know, our age as adults? And we're playing sports or whatever it is that we do. Why is it suddenly that on this side of the field, at the end of the game, these people are jumping up and down, yay, 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 and these people over here are in tears, and there's this chasm? What's the difference between that and the daddy playing with his child? And the difference is the daddy playing with his child loves the child. And we have to do that as Christians everywhere. There still will be sports, but the other person's diminished joy, his suffering at losing, should temper our joy at winning. Track with me in a couple more instances. Beauty. All right. So in the child-parent paradigm, what if we have an aging mother who has a beautiful daughter? Does the aging mother resent her beautiful daughter? I mean, I guess on Sleeping Beauty that happened, but it doesn't usually happen. Normally, the aging mother thinks, that's so great, I have a beautiful daughter, and she's so happy. Why? Because she loves the daughter. Now, if a beautiful mother happens to have a disfigured daughter, you know what the beautiful mother does? She tries to hide the flaws of her daughter. Why does she do that? Because she loves her daughter. It's not a spirit of competition between them. And in a perfectly loving world, the beautiful people would always say, but I want to use my beauty to make the world more beautiful. And the disfigured people in a perfectly loving world would always say, well, I'm so happy that this other person is so beautiful, and I'm going to try to make my mark for Jesus in some way other than beauty. You see, there's no competition. Well, then if we talk about status, what do we have? A very famous and powerful dad, and he has a little boy who is tired of walking, can't walk anymore, wherever they're going, and he picks up the boy. Why does he do that? He carries him along because he loves him. The stronger will serve the weaker because he loves him. And what we find is the spirit of competition is gone. On the other hand, if you have a factory working dad, he's not strong and powerful. He's a factory working dad, you know, he's just a grunt, a blue collar guy. Then does he hate his son if his son grows up to be CEO of a corporation? No, he doesn't. Why? Because he loves his son. See, there's just no competition, no competitive spirit. And it's because they love each other, and that's what has to be in your life too. So you ask yourself this question. Does my personal pursuit of status or my desire to beat a rival out of a promotion flow out of obedience to these commands? So I want to be lifted up, you know? And then I want to beat him out of this position. All right, does that sound like this to you? Philippians 2:3. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory. Vainglory? Status. Let nothing be done because you're striving and you want status. Don't do that. But in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than himself. So I'm competing for a position at work. And for me to get the position, that other guy has to lose the position. Now, if I love that guy, I don't want him to lose the position. You think, but I want the position. Yeah, I get that. But it's not going to be possible for you to wish him to lose the position if you love him, because you're going to esteem him better than yourself. Think, whoa, we're in deep water here, aren't we? Romans 12:15. Rejoice with them that rejoice and weep with them that weep. So I want the position at work. For me to get the position, the other guy has to lose the position. And I'm supposed to weep with the people who weep and rejoice with the people who rejoice. So he gets the position and I lose it. How do I feel? Happy. I'm going to rejoice with him. I get the position. He loses it. How do I feel? I'm sorry for him. I'm going to weep with him. Think, no way. You know, nobody could ever do that. No way. I can't. I won't. I hear what the scripture is saying and I'm saying, no way. Yes, there is too a way. Now, that doesn't mean that if you get the promotion, you have to give it up or whatever, you know, God's will be done. But we're talking about a spirit of competitiveness. If you and your son were going for the same promotion and the son got it instead of you, hopefully you would be glad for your son. And if you got it instead of your son, hopefully you would be sorry for your son. And that's what we call love. And that is possible outside of a father-son relationship. And that's what we're aspiring to. 1 Corinthians 10:24. Let no man seek his own, but every man another's wealth, or every man another's welfare. When the position came available, I would have been glad to see you take it. Now, I'm going to do my best for the Lord and for the company. But if you get it, I'm going to rejoice with you. I think that's great because I was seeking your well-being. Wow. Luke chapter 14, verse 8, just the underlying parts. Remember the story of the banquet. When you go to a banquet, sit down in the lowest room, not at the VIP table, but as far from the VIP table as you can get. Because if you exalt yourself, you're going to be humbled. If you humble yourself, you're going to be exalted. And these are commands. So when I am competing with somebody, I want you to go down and I want to have status myself. When you're doing that, does this sound like these commands? I think not. Social networking sites, according to Jean Twenge, social scientist, she says social networking sites encourage users to highlight only certain aspects of themselves. You show your good side. Or if you're overweight, you only show your face. Credit and other sleights of hand also make it seem like other people have much more money than you do, even if they're actually struggling just as much or more. We hide our debt, but we flaunt our possessions. It's competition. I'm not going to show you how my bank book is suffering for me to have these possessions. I just want you to think I'm wonderful because I'm competing with you. See, that's ugly. That's a spirit of competition that doesn't need to be in the Christian's life. John Mayer, the famous celebrity singer, he was pointing out how it is in social media, that sort of thing, how we are competitive, like the girl who'll take 100 photos until coming up with one she's happy with, which inevitably looks nothing like her. She'll post that one on her social media page and then write something like, "I don't give a profanity what you think of me." Oh yeah, you took 100 pictures, you found one that looks nothing like you, and you decided to post that and say, "Well, I do that because I don't care what people think." Yes, you do. You're in competition with people, and that's why so much of what we do is done. Similarly, John Mayer himself talks about how he can leave a reject pile of clothes in his own closet so high that his cleaning lady can't figure out how one man can step into so many pairs of pants in a week. We're competing. We have to look just so. And if we don't look just so, then it bothers us because we're losing the competition. So does my personal pursuit of status, you know, I want you to think I'm wonderful. And my personal pursuit of status that happens to knock another guy down so he doesn't get what I want. Does that sound like these New Testament ideals? 1 Corinthians 13:5 again, love seeks not her own. So there's a promotion that one person is going to get at work. I would like to have the promotion. Another guy would like to have promotion. What does the loving person do? I'm seeking your wishes. I hope you get the promotion. If I get it, and I'm going to serve this company and serve the Lord well, so if it comes to me, it comes to me. But if it comes to me and not you, I actually will weep with you. I'm sorry you didn't get it because I wasn't seeking my own benefit in this world. I'm seeking yours. Philippians 2:17. Yes, and if I be offered upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I joy and rejoice with you all. Paul says, if I lose my life, because he was in prison with the threat of execution at this time, he says, if I lose my life serving you, then I'm glad. And he says it specifically at the very bottom of this slide, 2 Corinthians 13:9. We are glad when we are weak and you're strong. I want you to win. If my becoming weak helps you to be strong, then I'm glad. That's what I want. Again, in 1 Corinthians 10:33, Paul says, even as I please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit. You know, I wasn't trying to be the one who got the promotion. I mean, if I do, I do. But I'm not competing with you for these benefits. I will be sorry for you if you don't get the promotion, and I do. Because I am not seeking my own profit. You see how deep this is? I mean, what fraction of humanity would even seriously think about any of this? And yet, there it is. Very sad, a French author in the mid-1600s told the truth. He said, there is something not altogether unpleasant in hearing about the misfortunes of a friend. Sad. You know, oh, you know, your friend, something bad happened, and you somehow find yourself rejoicing in the competitiveness of your spirit. Well, you know, I guess that vindicates what I'm doing somehow. Very sad that it's that way. Celebrities, we find that this competition affects the way we think about people that we know something about who has celebrity status. Dr. Melanie Greenberg, clinical psychologist, she says, people also like to see celebrities fall. We idolize them, and then we want to bring them down because it shows that our lives aren't so bad. It's better to be us. We have more moral foundation. We have more inside. We have more genuineness. First, we lift them out of obscurity, showering them with worship, and then we start tearing them down again. We feel an urge to unseat or co-opt them. Envy morphs into aggression. So because we're proud, we can't see people do better than we do, and it becomes ugly, and we actually sort of rejoice when somebody crashes and burns. You realize, of course, that you're a long, long way from the heart of Jesus when this happens. And it's not just about celebrities. This article was written by a Christian woman in a Christian magazine, and she's talking about the mommy wars. She says, mention mommy wars to any parent on the planet, and they'll understand. Breastfeeding versus bottle, co-sleeping versus crib, working versus stay at home, public school versus homeschool, helicopter versus free reign. How many of us secretly, or not so secretly, build a case for why our parenting style is superior and therefore the right way? The message we send is that our way outranks your way. We're busy keeping up with the latest gossip on whose parenting strategies fell short of the mark. And we're certainly not loving our neighbor as ourselves when we feel superior in light of someone's struggle. Unwittingly, instead of being content to find my own direction and wish others well on their child-rearing quest, I have ended up in arguments and confrontations trying to convince women I respect that they are doing it wrong. I am on the front lines of the mommy wars, weapon drawn, ready to strike the opposition, and I'm not even sure why. It's competition. You know, I have to prove to you that my way of doing this is better than your way. And when we act like that, we're a long ways from the New Testament, where we don't compete. We rejoice with the people who succeed, and we weep with the people who don't succeed. We think the other person is more important than ourselves. We seek not the other person's benefits, but we seek to be a benefit to them. And we will very gladly spend and be spent in the service of other people. And if we are poured out as a sacrifice to make them happy, then we're happy. We rejoice in that. That's the New Testament. We're talking here about a new ability to be humble. And by that we mean that we're no longer going to be reluctant to serve anyone because we believe that our Christian life is essentially measured by being servant to everybody. That's what we honestly believe. and we drop out of the competition, the compulsion to compete with people so that we upstage them is just gone. And that humility is an important part of the Christian life. You say, that is impossible. Nobody could possibly live up to these ideals. I'm suggesting that if you're allowed to follow Jesus for another 200 years or another 500 years, you would be just like this. You would love everybody. You would serve absolutely everybody you ever could. And you would quit competing with people. What I'm talking about right now is your future. Even at this moment, God is leading you to behave like this. And as you listen to the Lord, this is what you'll do. This is what you have already begun doing. And as you follow Jesus, you're really going to be something, because this is the work of God in your heart at this very moment.